thank you for coming to this call. If you don't know me, just a little bit about me. My name is Parul. I'm obviously a Storygrid editor. I'm based in London. My background, I've worked in traditional publishing before. I didn't have a mentor like Sean. I wasn't that lucky. I simply learnt on the job. But now I integrate Storygrid tools into all my work. I happen to be a huge Harry Potter fan. I'm guessing quite a few of you might be, although Jewel, maybe not, if you haven't read it. I reread the series about once a year, sometimes twice. And maybe you have a series that you pick up for comfort or for the same thrill every year. I'd love to hear about that if we have time at the end. So just to give you a little bit of the structure for this hour, I'll do a little introduction to the series and the scene itself. Oh, no, amazing. Krista, if you've read them multiple times, I'm with you there. Yeah, I think they're brilliant. I love the book so much. So we'll do a short introduction to the series and the scene. And then we're going to go into the points that are on that sheet. Hold on, Renee, I'm just going to mute you. Oh, yeah, there we are. So we're going to look at the story event. We're going to look at value change, the five commandments, and then there'll be time to discuss and to go into deeper into any other questions you have. And actually, that can be the scene, or it can actually be more broader questions about the series or the book itself. Or if there's anything book-related that's keeping you up at night, if I can't answer you immediately on the call for any reason, don't worry, we can continue to chat. And actually, we have loads of fantastic editors in the community as well. But feel free to comment as we go along. Otherwise, yeah, I'm going to kickstart with this. So I've selected, actually, can I have a show of hands? How many of you have actually read the scene? Great. Awesome. Great. Elizabeth, Leslie, Rachel, Jen. Fantastic. So you may have noticed I've chosen the core event. So I've chosen the hero at the mercy of the villain. And I did that on purpose, actually, because I thought that sometimes it can be quite hard, as someone pointed out, to identify the five commandments in the scene. The core event is a bit more dramatic than some of the other scenes. And so it's a really good way to practice. I like core events a lot, because I find them a very good way to practice looking at five commandments, practice looking at value change, looking at the story event. Okay, so we're going to start off by looking at literal action. So what are the characters literally doing? And I've seen questions before about, you know, what is the definition of literal action? And that's literally, what are the characters doing? Are they in a forest? Are they having coffee? Are they walking? Are they talking? And in this case, we have Harry and Riddle in the Chamber of Secrets. They're talking. And actually, it's a bit of a slow burn argument. There's something quite sinister underneath that that we can see that Harry can't immediately see. But literally, they are talking. And Ginny is unconscious. And like I say, feel free to, if you have any questions, do butt in. What is the essential action of what the characters are doing in the scene? So here we're talking about what is happening on the emotional, like non-tangential level. So I feel like this is related to what is the character trying to achieve? What is it that matters so much to them that they're doing what they're doing? We know that Harry is trying to rescue Ginny from the chambers. He wants to preserve life. And this will take us back to the global genre. And as I said, this is the core event. The core event is an obligatory scene. Therefore, it turns on life and death. So it makes sense to me that Harry is trying to preserve life in this scene. Tom Riddle, on the other hand, he wants to destroy life. He wants to kill Harry and come back to life. That's his ultimate aim. Okay, so now we move on to the topic of value. How does everyone feel about value? Does anyone find it a bit confusing? Yes. Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that part of the reason it can seem, yes, exactly. Sure, there can be several values at once, absolutely. And also, we all have a slightly different perspective based on our experience. So whenever I get stuck, I always think back to some of the, you know, Sean and the editors phrasing around value. So Sean says a story value is simply a human experience. It's a judgment of reality. It's about changing from positive to negative or negative to positive on that spectrum. So you're, that the line, you know, in Rachel has those wonderful value spectrums on all the secret guides that we have on the website. And I always go back to looking at the values on either side and thinking about how it must shift. So obviously you've got, like I say, positive, negative and vice versa, and then double positive and double negative. Now, the value is going to be a value that relates to one of the genres that's in your story, right? So my take on Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets is it is action, arguably, although, and I definitely would argue for that, for it being life and death at stake. We have worldview maturation going on as well, because Harry's got his internal understanding of the world shifting, and perhaps performance with Quidditch as well in this book. So the value that you're looking for is going to be one of the genres. Having said that, when it's a core, when it's an obligatory scene, the value is likely to be, it should be relating to the global value, so life and death. So you're going to try and so I said something about how people come with different values. And in fact, Sean talks about this in one of his podcast episodes about the fears, the P-H-E-R-E. And he talks about how two editors can say, can describe a value change slightly differently, and that's okay. Where it becomes a bit trickier is when their value shifts seem totally unrelated. I think we should generally be in the same arena, but one writer or editor may look at that scene ever so slightly different. So I suppose what I'm saying is I'm always less concerned with the specifics of how it's described, but just the broader change, whether it's going towards life or towards death. Does that make sense? Okay, great. So what life value has changed for one or more of the characters in the scene? So let's look at Harry and let's look at Tom Riddle. So Harry moves from danger. So if I look at the beginning, I wish it was a first edition, but it's not. It's like a 10th, 15th edition or something like that. But if I look at the start of that scene where he's standing at the end of a very long, dimly lit chamber, you continue looking down that scene. We know that something not so good is going to happen. We know that there's danger imminent. But it doesn't really, so the minute he sees Ginny, for example, that's when we can see it starting to escalate. So there is a threat of danger. And the biggest moment, the value change that I would initially put down is verbal threat to life. So it's danger, threat to life. It's when Tom openly says that he's there to kill Harry. And then as you go through the fight scene, we know that Harry gets bitten by the basilisk and he drifts into unconsciousness. So I would put that down, unconsciousness. And then he comes back to life as the phoenix's tears heal him. So I would put down life. Tom Riddle moves from risk of major physical injury. This is, I find this interesting, the way that, this is a children's book, and I think this has an impact on the type of values that we talk about. And this is something that myself and another editor, Rebecca, are going to be exploring, because I think values, when it's as applied to children's books, it's slightly different. Tom is always at risk. Voldemort, sorry, is always at risk when he's near Harry. And he doesn't always know it because he is arrogant enough to think that love isn't important. He's arrogant enough to think that because he's hidden his soul in so many Horcruxes, he cannot be killed. But actually, as we found out from the book one, we know that actually even the touch of Harry in book one, because of the protection in his mother's, from his mother, the death of his mother, his blood protects him. Tom is not scared of Harry in this one, but he really should be. And as he comes to realize, he will die. Tom Riddle as a Horcrux, a ghost, a shadow will die. So he starts, in my estimation, from risk of major physical injury to death. And remember that death is, it's not the end of him, it's a semi-end of him. Okay. Are there any other values that you would put out when you were going through it? Did you think of anything? Is there anything I've missed out? No? Okay. Ginny. Yes, you're right. Actually, thank you. Thank you very much, Krista. You're absolutely right. Ginny moves from unconsciousness to conscious. Weak to strong, Harry finds his strength, Harry's awareness. Yes, yeah, so actually, it's a good point. I've tracked here the external global value, which is life and death. You could absolutely track the worldview as well at the same point. The way I approach scene analysis is I will do one at a time so that I don't go totally crazy, because it can be quite complicated, and often there are there's a lot of thought that has to go into, well, why? What does that mean? So going back to the example, when I think about Tom Riddle at the beginning of that, thinking about the valley he's at, I could have started with, oh, he's arrogant, or oh, he's, I could go down a rabbit hole in that direction. But I brought it back to, well, hold on. This is action, this is life and death, and this is a core event. So I'm guessing it's, you know, life and death. If it wasn't the core event, I would be a bit more open-minded, and I would think, okay, yeah, there are going to be other values that I will track first. But, so you're absolutely right. Hold on, Krista, Ginny, value switches to Tom. Yes, yeah, absolutely. That's a really good observation. Thank you. Okay, so what life value should I highlight on my story grid spreadsheet? I would put down danger to the edge of unconsciousness to life. So danger to the edge of unconsciousness to life. Now, here's the thing. You might put something slightly different, but you're probably going to be in the same arena as me. You might not describe it. Maybe you wouldn't say edge of consciousness. Maybe you would describe it differently. But ultimately, you're tracking change. And that is the core part of, for me, for scene analysis. When I look at scenes, I don't know if you've ever had this before, maybe with your own work, where you've Karen, danger to dying to life. Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely valid to say that. I find with scene analysis, and I want to beat this drum a fair bit on this call, that when I'm stuck on a scene as an editor looking and I think, oh, something's not working, scene analysis is where it helps me. And it's when I don't find the value shift is big enough. And so doing these practice analysis with the masterworks, I find incredibly helpful. And also, if I'm looking, so say for example, I'm looking at a middle grade action book, and something isn't working, and maybe in the core event, I would look at the scene analysis and think specifically, what is the value change in the Harry Potter core event, and how does that compare to the scene I'm looking at? Is it comparable? Is there something I can learn from that? Is there something I can transfer across? How powerful is the value? Quick question from Ian. I think of value as plus to double negative. Positive to negative at a high level. Is that wrong? I.e., it goes from positive to negative, or vice versa. Is that wrong? I'm not sure I fully understand. Thomas, I'll get to your question in a second. So, goes from positive to negative, or vice versa. It seems like it could go so many things regarding the specifics. So when I'm doing a scene analysis, I will be focusing on one genre at a time and tracking that. I'll always start with the global. And I'm basically looking to see what shifts, whether it's shifting towards life or whether it's shifting towards death. Does that answer the question? I guess I try and keep it as simple as possible. I'm not trying to be smart. I'm just simply trying to move it. I'm trying to see how it moves. And actually, Ian, that's a fantastic question about, Thomas, big in what way? That's actually valid. And I sometimes ask myself that question. Do you know, there's a fantastic article that has I want to just share with you, or maybe one of the other editors on the call can do this. The Power of 10. I think it was Kim and Valerie have an article about the Power of 10, which is about progressive complications and how you can mark them up. But I like the idea of actually thinking about grading values. I will share that. Let's see if I've got it here. Otherwise, I'll share it afterwards in the guild. But if I'm stuck and I don't have access to very much, and I want to analyze whether a value change is big enough, I will compare as many books as I can for that core event. It is in my opinion, it is a subjective opinion. But if you read enough in a genre, you get a sense of whether a scene is more dramatic. Thank you, Leslie. You'll get a sense of whether something is more dramatic or not. And actually, interestingly, I suppose a really, really obvious way of analyzing this, if you look at an action scene, so a core event like Harry Potter, like this particular book, and you compare this core event to an adult action book, you'll see a dramatic difference. So you'll see that in this core event, for example, he stabs a diary. He doesn't stab a man or a boy. His way of thinking, his worldview is also a lot, it's a little bit more immature than an adult's worldview. He's in danger, yes. But I would argue that Tom Riddle, while he is scary, it's not the same as being confronted by some of the other bullies or villains you might find in an adult action book. Okay, I hope that answers your question. Happy to take more. I'm just going to crack on, just conscious of time. Okay, so just to go back down to value change, just one last thing. You don't have to have it perfect, especially when you're starting out, but also it is subjective. Remember that we all bring our own experiences to this, and that's how we describe things differently. It's important to just be in the right arena. And I think bouncing it off somebody else is really, really helpful. And the more analysis you do, and so that's why I love the editor's roundtable, for example, being able to see how editors have analyzed all the different genres. So if you haven't looked at that, I would absolutely recommend that. Okay, so now we're going to head to the five commandments. So how the scene abides to the five commandments of storytelling. Now, somebody had a question about the inciting incident and how do you identify what the inciting incident is? And I always think of Sean talking about the ball of chaos and how it's something that is disturbing the state of whatever the state of normal is. Now, bearing in mind that we're already in a pretty tense situation, Harry is alone. He's unfortunately lost Ron and Professor Lockhart, and he's walking through the chamber. If you look at the scene, you'll see that. So imagine that he walks in the chamber. He comes up to the pillars. Harry had to crane his neck to look up into the giant face above. It was ancient and monkey-like. And then a few lines later, and between the feet, face down, lay a small black-robed figure with flaming red hair. To me, that's the inciting incident. Imagine, so if I'm stuck and I'm thinking, I'm not sure, I think, what if Ginny was sitting there having a cup of tea? Like, he'd be like, hey, Ginny, you're safe. Great, let's go home. There'd be nothing, there'd be no worry. Like, the mystery would be over, the danger would be over. But no, in fact, she's unconscious. And he yet has no idea how dangerous this situation is, which is great because we have the progressive complications to come to. Which, leads us to the next point, which is the turning point. And I've seen comments about, well, what is the turning point? How'd you figure it out? So just as a definition again, the turning point is that moment when new information crops up. It's new information or a new situation arises and the character is forced to change. They're forced to make, to do something differently. So after he sees Ginny on the floor, he's trying to get her up, right? He says, Ginny, please wake up. He's desperate. And then he discovers How creepy is that? You've got Tom Riddle staring at you, standing there in a dark chamber. That's a progressive complication to me. And it's not just any old, it's not just anyone, it's Tom Riddle who he's been conversing with. So there's a seed of doubt being planted here, right? And Harry is confused. Why won't she wake? That's a progressive complication. Riddle says, she's alive, but only just. Just to verify, finding Ginny would be causal. Yes, absolutely. Because it's not just a coincidence. This is something that's been caused. The inciting incident, this is all part of Voldemort's plan. He wants to take Ginny's life. So page 227, if you have the book, you'll see that it's actually packed with progressive complications. And this is all coming in through revelation. So there's a whole bunch of information that's being pulled through where Harry understands that Tom is a ghost, preserved in the diary for 50 years. Aha. And then Harry asks for help and Riddle doesn't move. And then his wand goes. We're getting quite close to the turning point. Do you feel it? For me, you can start to feel the tension rise. And there's a point where it snaps. It goes too far. You're suddenly all the thought. If I was Harry in that chamber, if you were Harry, this is the point where the penny drops and you realize that actually something has happened or something has been revealed that you have to act on. So for me, the turning point, which is a revelation rather than an action that he does, is that Tom Riddle reveals that he is Lord Voldemort. So he explains, and this is on page 228. I know you, if you have the PDF or the Word document, the page number won't be on there. But he has explained that he is who he is and that he wants to kill Harry. Do you have any questions about the turning point? Did you discover it? Did you find it? Great. Yes, you can feel it, Elizabeth. Karen, great, fantastic. Really good. Yeah, it really is a creative way. Interesting, Rachel. Okay, so you're torn between the revelation that Tom is Lord Voldemort and Dumbledore sending help that enables Harry to act. Ah, I like the second one. I'll come to it in a moment, because actually that is part of one of the other commandments. Thomas says, I thought a greater turning point is when Harry acknowledged his helplessness and asked for help. That is definitely it's coming into one of the commandments, and we'll get to that in a moment. So this comes to the crisis point. Harry is a very independent character. He doesn't like taking help. You'll notice that in the Chamber of Secrets as a whole, so in the beginning, in the first act and the second act, whenever he has a choice to go to ask for help, he will refuse it. So in the beginning hook of the Chamber of Secrets, when he first hears the voices, he doesn't tell Dumbledore about them. He doesn't want to. So the crisis then is, does he tell Dumbledore about the voices or does he keep the knowledge to himself? And in the middle build, when he is accused of attacking Justin, he has a chance to tell the truth to Dumbledore, but that's a risk of being considered dangerous. He's really afraid of his ability to be a Parsonoth, and so he doesn't. However, in this scene, in this crisis point, I believe the crisis is, should he try to fight the basilisk or should he try and ask for help? He has to make a decision at this point. I feel like he is prone to wanting to be a hero, and this comes out as a theme, comes out in The Goblet of Fire, where he gets accused of always wanting to be a hero. And so this point, I feel he's acknowledging his helplessness. So this is very interesting to me. When you are unsure of a concept, whether it sits in one commandment or the other. And actually, Krista and Thomas and Rachel, all of your points are valid, but actually it's quite close by. So sometimes we're actually talking, it's not that far apart. So it's very easy to bleed. I feel like it can be quite easy to bleed in together. But for me, the crisis is, again, does he choose to fight it on his own, or does he try and ask for help? And actually, he decides that actually he has to go for help. It's gone too far. As an editor, do you believe each scene needs a turning? Oh, yes. I tell you what, here's a, Ian, here's a challenge for you. I would be curious if you pick up maybe this book, or maybe another book that you absolutely love. And even if you just look at three scenes and tell me if you can find those three scenes, if it doesn't have a turning point, I'd be curious. Because I find that if there isn't a turning point, if it's in a draft novel, it's not working. And sometimes when I don't like a scene of a published book, it's because I don't believe their turning point is strong enough. Okay, hold on, I've got some more questions here. Kim, is that crisis point of asking for help for both the internal and external genres? Yeah, that's a really amazing question. Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I think this is what I love about Harry Potter so much, is that worldview is so important. He's forced to shift his way of thinking. Think about this. He's been growing up with the Dursleys. He's been such an independent boy, and so suspicious of everyone. I don't blame the way he acts. It makes sense in the story that he doesn't actually ask for help naturally. He tries to be the hero. He does what he thinks is right. And I think that absolutely the internal and external merge together it's a point where he has to realize that he has a community behind him. Mickey never forgives a missing turning point. Yep. Is it a revelational active, says Laurie? This is action. This is him calling for, this is him saying, there's a line, I think, where he says, help me. Yeah. So this is when Tom Riddle says, Dumbledore's been driven out of this castle by the mere memory of me. And then he says, he's not as gone as you might think. And obviously this links back, if you remember, to when Dumbledore says, you will find, I'm sure you can correct me on this, but you'll find that I'm always there for those who need my help. He says that earlier on in the book. And so he asks for help. And at that point, the Phoenix comes through. Jewel, yep, good point. Jewel says, you can write scenes without turning points, but they're really boring, and Sean calls them shoe leather. Yep, absolutely. Is this a crisis? Is this crisis a best bad choice or irreconcilable goods? Harry doesn't like either choice. And there may not be any coming back from either choice. What do you guys think? Best bad choice? Yep, I think that's right. I'm sure you could argue. Yeah. You could probably argue both ways. It's funny, a lot of the conversations when I discuss a piece with another editor, sometimes we acknowledge that you can argue both ways. At some point, one might want to make a decision on one or the other, but I think it's absolutely fine. Michael says, which paragraph is he asking for help? Seems like Dumbledore sends Fawkes and the Hat prior to saying, help me. Ah, it's this line. I recognize that it's quite tame, but I actually took it to heart. Riddle is trying to turn Harry into thinking that there is no hope, that he is far more powerful, that he's so powerful that he's driven Dumbledore out. But Harry, it says he speaks at random. He's not as God as you might think. I think that in the first three books in the series, Harry Potter, bear in mind that Harry is 11, 12, and 13. the turning points and the crises are perhaps, I want to say, a bit tamer. And the way I'd probably more formally describe it is on the value shift. It's not as close to death. It's more sanitized version of leading towards death than you might find as the stories progress. So in the books, so from book four onwards, it feels more young adult because he is older. And actually the death, and I've got a list of all the different core events across the books, the death becomes, the value shift, sorry, become a bit darker. Okay, so crisis. Climax. So I feel like this should be pretty obvious to everyone, the climax. I say that, it may not be, but I'd be curious to see. Tony, yes, I'll give that to you in a second. So Tony's just said, can we have a list of all the core events across the books? Yeah, I will absolutely do that in 1 minute. But the climax is that Harry asks for help using the sorting hat and the sword of Gryffindor falls out. Harry kills the basilisk, who is now blind from the Phoenix's attacks. And we know that Harry gets stabbed. He feels the poison spreading and he starts to lose consciousness. And then the Phoenix tears actually start to heal him. And he manages to use the tooth and stab the diary. And actually, I've just realized, just a point, Krista. This trips me up, the idea that some things, Krista says, the idea that things have to occur right together. Here, I don't think the crisis happens in one blow. Yes, Krista, that's exactly the point I was going to make. No, thank you for that. So you're saying, yeah, exactly. The question comes when he realizes he has a backup, and the crisis question is answered when he says, help me, and the hat delivers a sword. I agree with you. I think that the seed is planted earlier when he says that Dumbledore is not as gone as you'd like, and then when he asks for help. I think that if this was an adult book, this would be a lot. It would be a lot more obvious. I'm just going to cut and paste the core events. I apologize in advance for the typos because I typed this up just before the call. This is what I believe are the escalation of core events across the series as a whole. Let me just cut and paste this. Okay. Let's see if this comes through. Okay. And the reason I did this was because I was curious about the level of the value change, actually, that occurs across the different core events and whether they escalate. I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent here, but I'm quite interested in the final book, The Deathly Hallows, and the fact that it's pretty dramatic, right? Harry sacrifices himself to the world. You know, he sacrificed himself to save the world and he allows Voldemort to kill him. So we're talking about the height of drama and he's as close to death as he can possibly be. However, if you think about his interaction with Voldemort, he has this innocence about him. So even though we're so close to death, to the point where we have death, he's surrounded by the shadows of his mentors, essentially, his parents, all the people that Voldemort has killed. He never tries to kill Voldemort. He does the counter jinx. That's my wand hand. I haven't had any practice, but he never tries to kill Voldemort because he's pure. If this was an adult novel, I think it would be difficult to be able to allow a character who just sacrifices himself and says, kill me. Whereas in a young adult and a middle grade series, you can do that. And I'm making this point because if you go back to this scene in the Chamber of Secrets and the core event, and we look at the value change, this is different to what you would find if this was an adult scene, core event. So Chamber of Secrets is book two. He's only 12 years old. The value shift is naturally going to be a bit, for lack of a better word, sanitized, tamer. It's still seismic, and it's definitely seismic for the audience that's reading it. I mean, I'm a fan, but you know what I mean? The primary audience, which are the children. Okay, I hope that makes sense. Do we have any other questions before I continue? Nope. Okay. So, resolution. So we're very happy because the diary has been destroyed. Yes. Riddle is gone. And the resolution is that now, and remember, he now takes on quite an adult role. He leads Ginny out of the chambers. Remember, she's babbling and quite distressed. And he says, like, don't worry. No one's actually going to worry that you did all these things. It's actually, we're happy that you're alive. He picks up. Jules, sorry. I'll come to you in a second. Oh, no. Let me answer that first. So how do you know what is the climax? I thought it was when Harry plunged the snake fang into the diary. Yeah, so interesting. So what is the definition of the climax? It's when you make the decision and you see what happens. So he's made the decision to ask for help. And I think the climax is quite a big scene. I think it encompasses a number of things. I don't think it's just one thing. I think it's a whole series of things. Now, Kim says, is that bit where Tom talks about how he turned in Hagrid and all that, is that the speech in praise of the villain? Yes, Kim, absolutely. Yeah, very good point. Thank you. And also, speech in praise of the villain, I find this interesting because I feel like it seeps into this entire chapter, because the fear we have of the unknown in this, we have had a creature or an unknown villain for quite a while in this book who has been picking off people and cat and petrifying them. Now, we are pretty scared, we the reader, and on behalf of the protagonist. I feel that I realize that speech in praise of the villain can be actually talking about how great someone is. It could be the villain even talking about themselves. But in my mind, it can also be the subtle fear that you inject. Oh, sorry, my headphones just went a bit funny. Can you still hear me? Yes, okay, great. Thank you. Yes, the climax, we're talking about the climax. I think it's quite a large, chunky scene. And it's absolutely satisfying. I really loved this climax. I thought it worked really well. I feel like we get a chance to see Harry's innate connection with Gryffindor, the fact that he is truly brave, as we find out later, that only a true Gryffindor could have pulled that sword out of the hat. We see his, what is to be the lifelong connection, lifelong, poor Dumbledore, but, you know, lifelong connection to Dumbledore, a connection he's never had with anyone else before. And we see the arrogance of Tom Riddle, which will come back to haunt him later on. And we meet the Horcrux, which is going to come back to haunt Harry. And as we know, cost Dumbledore his life in following books. So the resolution, going back, is that he leads Ginny out of the chambers. They find Rod? Who's Rod? Find Ron, Professor Lockhart, and they fly back into the girls' bathroom, holding on to the Phoenix's tail, and Harry has essentially saved the day. He still doesn't get many answers, even at the end in this resolution. He doesn't get many answers about why he's being attacked. This won't come for quite some time. Do we have any questions at this point? Okay. So I want to just talk a little bit about scene analysis as a whole, and why I think it's difficult and also wonderful. So personally, I find that trying to find the Five Commandments gets a little bit trickier, or you need a little bit more, you need sort of smaller tools in a way, the further you go down into a piece of writing. So you start off at an act, you go down to the sequence and the scene and the beat. And I feel sometimes it can be hard to identify where the Five Commandments sit. Greg, yep, I will absolutely do that. You've asked about the core event. But just to finish this thought really quickly, I have a theory on why I believe it's harder to identify the five commandments, and I think that's because the drama that's required. So if you look at something like a crisis point, the global crisis point for in a book will inevitably be more dramatic than the crisis point in a beat or a scene. So it can be a bit tricky, but having said that, it's incredibly helpful. I find that, like I said earlier, analyzing masterworks, the more I do, the better I understand story structure. And it honestly feels difficult at the start of, it can feel difficult right at the start, but persevering is very good. And it really does help you understand why a scene, why you like a scene or why you don't like a scene. Now, if I get stuck, I personally anchor on the crisis point. So I'll try and think, was this something that the character, was there a decision that the character had to make that meant that that led to the possibly climactic, in layman's terms, dramatic moment. If I watch a film, I'll think of, often it's like what they're hinting to at the in the trailer, or I'll think of the moment when I couldn't look away, because I'm always trying to anchor around that point. There must have been a crisis, and close to the crisis is probably going to be the climactic moment, and from there, then I'll try and work backwards. So, like I say, I find that maybe different editors have different points that they just are drawn to more. For me, it's the crisis point. Okay, so I'm just going to go to the questions now. Kim, this just came to me. This chapter encompasses most of the elements of the hero's journey. Yes, absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. I think that this is not what Harry signed up for. He doesn't want this. He just wants to save Ginny. He's never tried to search for or find Lord Voldemort. Unfortunately, he has no choice. He's being presented with a problem, and he denies that choice. You know, he doesn't want to accept that fact. He's been given clues right from the start, but he's forced to take on that mantle of being the hero. And he tries to defeat Voldemort, as we see, but in the end, he needs help to do that. And I've got a message. And he needs help to do that, and he does eventually overcome the villain. Okay, I'm going to go to the question. So Greg says, could you explain more about the core event? Is there only one core event in the book? And how does that relate to the 15 scene spine? Obligatory scenes. Yeah, so there's one core event. There is one core event, although you might have, so for example, say you have hero at the mercy of the villain in an action story. You could have more than one hero at the mercy of the villain, but there'll be one that is the most dramatic, where I suppose the biggest clash occurs. A good example that I'm finding, where a series where there's a lot of examples of multiple core events, I'll come to this definition in a second, is Killing Eve. So a few of us have a podcast, and we look at Killing Eve, and we're realizing, for example, the concept of hero at the mercy of the villain happens multiple times, but in the series as a whole, the core event, which is likely to happen in the end payoff towards the end, because this is where the hero really has to bring their gift to life. They're being forced to take, to bring their essence to the situation they find themselves in. So in Harry's case, he's shown multiple times in this story where he doesn't want to ask for help, but in this instance, he's forced to. He's had a shadow of threat, starting from Dobby, threatening that there's actually something sinister about to happen in school, through to when he hears the voices and students are being attacked. But this last scene is when the drama really kicks off. This is the scene where it comes together. This is the scene we want to read. In terms of how it relates to the 15 the core scenes, the core event is one of the obligatory scenes. Does that make sense? So, in fact, if you look at all the links are online. I also have it in paper form. The sort of action cheat sheets, or the secrets of the worldview genre, secrets of the action genre where you'll see the obligatory scenes listed out, you'll always see the core event there. So, for example, love scene is sacrifice of lover, where one lover has to prove their selfless love for the other. Does that make sense, Greg? Do you need any more for clarification? Okay, great. So another question. Okay. I think I worked more at the beat level rather than the scene. Is there a benefit to that, or should I back up and focus further away? Rivka Sleef. I believe that Sean talks about staying at a scene level. I find the beat level helps if I'm stuck. But actually, you can end up going quite deep into the weeds. I think that beat level can come later on. But when you're starting, I would go at the scene first at the fool's cap, at the macro level, and then you can start doing the obligatory scenes. And then you can go out and actually plot out the entire book scene by scene. Beat by beat is quite intense. Okay, and let's have a look. Thank you, guys. Thank you for being so interactive and asking questions. It's such a great book, and it's really awesome to be able to analyze this book. Okay, so Rachel says, when analyzing a scene, do you generally assume that the chapter itself is a scene, even if, like in Harry Potter, the scenes run pretty long, barring something like a major location change? I was catching the beats happening, which sometimes tripped me up for the whole scene. I don't assume that the chapter itself is a scene. Sometimes that is the case, but I've definitely found instances where it isn't. Going back to Killing Eve, because I spent a lot of time analysing Killing Eve, we've definitely noticed, if you think of an episode like a chapter, we've definitely noticed that the sequences run over an episode, can run over an episode. It is, I think, mind you, it's quite neat. If you want to wrap it up in a chapter, that's fine. And it can often fall in that sort of segregation, but it doesn't always. I was catching the beats happening. Yeah, I know what you mean. I find with editing as a whole and the concept of even trying to analyze, that all these things that you do where you find yourself tripping up on things that don't help you at the time, just that action of tripping up helps you get better at it next time, if that makes sense. So all of this is worthwhile, just even recognizing where you're tripping up is really smart, because then you recognize where the beat is. Okay, so Tony, I echo Rachel's questions and find myself torn when writing my own chapter ends, wanting to end with a crisis question or the climax and bring resolution at the beginning of the next chapter. Is this patently wrong? I'm not entirely sure. I don't think it's necessarily wrong. Are there any other editors on here who want to chip in?
Yeah, Peril, I'll just jump in very quickly on that, because I've had clients ask that same question. And you can absolutely break your chapter there at the crisis point and pick up the scene in the next chapter. That's one of the tricks of the trade. Or you can end a chapter at a cliffhanger. That also works. But I recommend not doing either of those two things too often, especially the cliffhanger, like maybe one or maybe two in a book, because it gets really annoying for the reader. Mm-hmm. And what you really want to do is study narrative drive and understand what that is, because that is the thing that's going to keep your reader turning pages. You can lean on these other little tricks sometimes as sort of crutches if you need them, but focus on the narrative drive first and go from there.
Thank you. Do you know, it suddenly occurs to me that I don't have an absolute answer about whether this is necessarily different for children's and young adult, because I think there are differences between young adult and even when it comes to applying story grid or applying structure, just in terms of what has worked well for a number of authors. I would be interested to see, I haven't done it, but I'd be curious to know in this book, because I haven't analyzed it chapter by chapter, if you were to pick up a few chapters yourself and have a look and see whether you think how J.K. Rowling has done this. Okay, let's see. Some more questions. I'm loving having all these questions. Thank you so much. Julia, thank you for that. how did J.K. Rowling write the story without StoryGrid? Wow, it's a good point. And actually, what's interesting is if you look online, you can see a little bit about her plotting. And I don't know if you've noticed, she very meticulously plotted this. She's planted seeds right from the beginning. So she's a very big plotter as a start. But I'm also sure that certain readers would probably think she needs the story grid. It's a bit controversial in her later novels where she had very little editing. Sean has probably done, yes. Okay, great. So I think I've answered all the questions. Is there anything else? Have I missed anything? Now's your chance. We have another 10 minutes left. Tony, yes, there's a plotting graph online that very much resembles a story grid. Heather, yes, the notes will be posted from here. I believe that's right, isn't that Valerie?
Yeah, I'll post a recording of this call in the forum, and it'll actually be on your guild dashboard. That's where you'll be able to find everything for the StoryGrid Guild. All of the week's deliverables will be right there on the dashboard, and you can access that from your StoryGrid account. And in terms of notes, the only thing that's really here is Peril mentioned the progressive complication article that Kim and I wrote a while ago, and she also posted the core events for all of the story grid books, the Harry Potter books. So, Peril, maybe if you could pop that in the forum.
Yes. Absolutely. I'm going to tidy it up a little bit because I literally did that off on the fly. But I want to actually think about it and fix it up a little bit. There are, you know what, rather than me talk about narrative drive, there are some fantastic links about narrative drive. But I like, I forget who wrote it. I'm sure one of the editors will post that in quite quickly. The one thing I want to say, which I find crops up time and time when I talk to writers, and perhaps you don't have this sense, but it's like, do I really have to look at story from a scene by scene perspective? Do I really have to do multiple drafts? And I find it interesting to, when I think of some of the writers that I've worked with who are published, I realize how much time they've spent drafting and redrafting. And what StoryGrid is, I can see, does just makes it a lot more formal and actually adds a template and makes it easier to do. So I suppose what I'm saying is, while it can sometimes seem painful to do this analysis, I think it's incredibly useful. Does anyone have any questions about scene analysis? Would you like to talk about one of the five commandments? Is there a commandment that you feel more, just really quickly, that you feel more strongly towards? Okay, we've got a question. Hold on. Is there an overall weight for value changes that you editors expect per genre? Action, positive and negative should be equal, or thriller should be more negative? I haven't noticed... okay, I'll cut Rick Sleaf, I'll come to you in a second. I don't believe that I've seen a difference in that way. I think the what has come to me, as I've seen lots of manuscripts and looked at books, is that it's just the degree of how dramatic you want your book to be. So if it's an action versus a thriller, it depends on how hard you want to push, you know, how dramatic, how exciting do you want your book to be. I don't believe there's a difference amongst the genres. If there are any other editors here who feel differently, please do raise your hands. I'd be happy to hear from you. Sue, how can you tell if a crisis question is just vague or if it's just not there? I think you know. So for me, I know when I see a crisis question. How irreversible is that decision? If I don't make that decision, what will happen? If I do make the decision, what will happen? I believe, again, there's another article about crisis points that one of the editors wrote about. I really forget which editor, because we have so many fantastic editors. Let me have a think and I'll find, Sue, which article it is. But this, I think you have to ask that question of whether or not it is a reversible decision. If it's reversible, it's not so much of a crisis. So in Harry Potter, for example, it really mattered that he made that decision to ask for help. It was the difference between life and death. If he hadn't made that decision, something very different would have happened. We wouldn't have had the subsequent books. So differentiating between the climax and the crisis. The crisis is the decision point. So it's literally just, when we talk about crisis point, it's quite short. We're literally just asking you to put a spotlight on the question, on the difficult choice that the character has to make. The climax is when they made that decision, that seeing that decision being played out. So when I think of the climax, I think of the sorting hat arriving and him actually making a decision to use those tools and fight Voldemort. Tony, you're very welcome. Rick, the crisis is the actual question. Yes, it's the question. If you hold that whole scene in your head and you think, what is the point in which Harry could have made a really bad decision? For me, it's either, like, he didn't have a choice. He had no weapons around him. He's facing a basilisk. He's facing Tom Riddle, but actually the basilisk is the life and death. And he's facing Ginny losing energy and potentially dying. He had to make a choice. Like, you know, do I ask for help or do I not? Like, what do I do? So that is definitely, it's a question. It's always a question. And the climax is the pro answering the question. I'm not sure what pro means, but the climax is the manifestation of that. It's the decision made. It's what we see subsequently. It's watching that unfold. The whole fight scene that he has with the basilisk, being punctured in the arm, poison spreading. To me, that is the climactic moment. Jewel, that's a really good point. Crisis to crisis question. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Stefan says, mind, in real life, we hardly face crisis dramatized. I suppose that's true. I suppose also we often face crises that we don't know are crisis points at that point. We don't fully understand the implications of what the crisis we're facing, especially when it's told. So when we see it from, when we're looking at a character, we are, from a third person point of view, we get an insight into that character's life. We can see, for example, how much danger Harry is in at that moment, the minute he steps into that chamber. We know it's not looking good. And we pick up on Riddle being a bad character, a bad actor, probably just a little bit earlier than Harry does. Thomas says, in which of the five commandments do you see that it's particularly important to approach it in a surprising way with change up from scene to scene so it doesn't seem overly routine or predictable? Poof, do you know what? I've seen this across every commandment. I'm not sure that there's one, if any other editors feel very strongly that there is one, but I think that I see this across all. Going back to Killing Eve, which is a phenomenal thriller series on BBC America and UK, I think one of the reasons season one, not season two, but the reason season one is so good is because, oh my God, every single commandment is innovated on. Okay, so we've got 2 minutes left, so I'm just going to quickly scroll down to see if there are any more questions. And guys, thank you so much for staying on the call and really being a part of this. I'm really excited to see how you guys use this information and start working on your own scenes. Jim says, how long should you spend on studying manuscripts versus direct work on your manuscript? Jim, so I'm an editor only. I don't write. So if there are other editors who are writers, they might want to add on the comments. We probably don't have time to chat. But really quickly, I think it should be alongside. I find that it helps I always advise writers to, if they're stuck at the foolscap level, to do some reading maybe before they even start their own foolscap, to use it as a point of comparison. But once you start writing, I don't see any harm in continuing to go deep into that world. I think obviously it's a balance of time. Every writer will also have their own individual circumstances. But I guess if you watch films, if you could watch a film a week, that'd be quite easy. You could try and identify the obligatory scenes and conventions and five on one masterwork, or you could listen to the podcasts that StoryGrid has, because they analyze story for you. So it's a, it's an hour a week potentially. And thank you for those who have, who've given their splits. Great. So I think we're probably quite out of time. Guys, it's been such a pleasure to have you guys on board. And please, if you have any further questions, please comment on the Guild. I'd be really happy to talk. I love talking about Harry Potter. So if you want to talk about any of the Harry Potter books, feel free to comment in the Guild. I'm very happy to analyze any of these books if you ever want to chat about them. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.